News director Tony Zor joined by Republican candidate Bill Weld, who's running for president in the Republican primary.
Tony, it's always a pleasure to be in this part of New Hampshire. As I told you, I came up here as a kid to camp out at Tuckerman's Ravine many times.
Yep, and you're the former governor of the state south of us, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I remember that name. Yeah, Massachusetts it was. Two terms in the 1990s.
I looked it up. The last time, the only time, in fact, in American history that an incumbent president has lost a primary was Franklin Pierce, New Hampshire's president. So I guess my first question is, why the Republican primary on an incumbent year?
Well, you know, I've got some things I want to do that aren't being done in Washington. And, you know, I've been an executive. I was head of the criminal division of the Justice Department under Ronald Reagan, 7 years in the Justice Department, and two terms as governor. And I think that's the best possible preparation for being president of the United States. I've, frankly, almost made this race twice before. But the reason I wanted to do it particularly this year is because the atmosphere has gotten so poisonous in Washington, and everyone hates each other down there. It's like a, you know, death spiral embrace between the two parties, and they need each other to scare their own base into giving them lots of money so they can get reelected. And it's a kind of a sick situation. And when I was in office, you know, the first thing I did was reach across the aisle and say, you Democrats in the legislature, let's get together every Monday afternoon and just have coffee and cookies and chat. And they said, sounds a little odd, but okay with us. And I purposely said, we'll start with your office, Mr. Speaker, and then your office, Mr. Senate President, because legislators don't like to be summoned by a governor particularly. And it went down very, very well. Goodwill begat goodwill. And we did a lot of stuff together, you know, financial reform, welfare reform, education reform, and the people appreciated it. So when Paul Cellucci and I ran for re-election, having been swept into office with 50.01% of the vote, we actually got 71% on the re-elect.
So you're running on a unity platform then?
Well, you could say that, yeah. I'm not promising I would have a Democratic running mate, but I certainly would have a bipartisan cabinet. Might even throw in a libertarian or two just to shake everybody up.
And I do want to know, one of the things I noted on your website, you specifically set aside a section for opioids, which has been huge in northern New England.
Oh, Massachusetts also. Yeah,
absolutely. And that actually surprised me because you gave a little kudos to Trump on taking on China, and that was part of your platform as well.
Yeah. No, not everything he does is wrong by any means. No, the reason I singled out opioids, first of all, I buried a 20-year-old and a 21-year-old in New York City who had one pill, one glass of wine, and woke up dead. And one of them was a family friend. Matter of fact, they were both family friends. So that issue hits home. But even apart from that, I've done a lot of work over the years with addiction, including with Patrick Kennedy, the former rep from Massachusetts, trying to persuade people that it's got to be a national public health emergency now. It's not a red letter priority for the criminal justice system. People are just between a rock and a hard place. And I think what Charlie Baker, who's the current governor in Massachusetts and was my, you know, chief cabinet secretary, what he did was good. He got everyone in one room and he banged heads, and including the doctors who thought they could do whatever they wanted. He said, no, we need protocols about how much you can prescribe and consequences for violation. And he had Big Pharma there, and they worked out a, you know, multi-party deal, which I think is a model for the rest of the country. And Charlie Baker and I tried to do that when I was governor, and he was my top assistant. And we did serve as a laboratory for the rest of the country in terms of welfare reform and education reform. So that's why I singled out that issue.
And when you talk about states being laboratories for the rest of the country, I feel like that's kind of a huge thing right now. We saw kind of in healthcare, there's the view that either we should do everything as one country or we should do things as laboratories and individual state efforts. Where do you see that balance?
Well, it depends on the issue. On education, I think that's a state and local responsibility. And, I made a grand bargain with the teachers union, not my constituents by any means, when I was in office. But we had, our economy was really humming because I was a anti-taxer in the small business community, which is where 80% of the jobs are created, appreciated that. So they built the next plant, et cetera. So we went from having the highest unemployment rate in the industrialized states to the lowest, just in my first term. So we had a ton of money. And I saw these huge disparities in spending between districts on education. You know, west in Wellesley, west of Boston, 26,000 a pupil per year. Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, the minority areas of Boston, 6,000 a year. So I said, no, that's not fair. And I put $7 billion onto the table. And I said, in return, I want some management givebacks. I want standards. I want accountability. I want high stakes tests in fourth, eighth, and 10th grade. If you don't pass them, you don't go on to the next grade. And we did all that. And the result was that Massachusetts went from the middle of the pack in terms of math and reading scores to number one in the country every year for 25 years, right up to including the present day. You can't argue with that. And that's a, you know, that's a state by state issue. That's not something where I want a more role for the federal government.
So what sort of issues would you see the federal government taking on more of a role in?
Well, not too many, frankly. I'm on the libertarian side of the Republican Party, so I believe in emphasizing individual liberties, and even at the expense of government power. And my motto when I was in office was, there's no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. And everyone in Washington has kind of forgotten that. They think there is government money and it's theirs. And that's a fundamental misconception that I would like to turn around if I get to Washington.
I was actually just interviewing another candidate yesterday, and they were bringing up the national debt, $22 trillion, $21 trillion right now.
Yeah.
Intergenerational debt. We're spending our grandkids' money.
I consider that a national security issue, and it's also a gun pointed right at the head of the millennials and the Gen Xers. You know, they're not going to see good times if nothing is done to corral that debt. And I was ranked the most fiscally conservative governor in the country when I was in office. I actually cut spending in absolute dollars year over year. In Washington, you know, if something goes up 10%, they call that a cut. I mean, they're just crazy about the budget down there. They think it's all their money. So that would be something, you know, with one hand, I would say, here's the olive branch. You know, I'm going to have a bipartisan cabinet, and let's get together. And the other hand, I would say, we are not going to continue these trillion-dollar deficits or any deficit at all. And this is not a partisan issue. If you look at the last 20, 30 years, the Democrats have actually done a better job on corralling the budget. Bill Clinton completely eliminated the deficit and ran a surplus. So it's not party. It's just who's being thoughtful and who recognizes that the taxpayer comes first.
But if we look back the past, I want to say, two decades, every president seems to double the amount of spending with every term. So
not Bill Clinton.
No, not Bill Clinton, but every president since. So I guess the question is there a bipartisan path to cut that trend, or is that something that we're kind of stuck on now that we've got the interest going?
Well, I would use the bully pulpit, and I've long said we should have a balanced budget requirement at the federal level, which is the law in all 50 states, 49, not including Vermont, Senator Sanders' state. So I would push for that. I'd push for term limits. I was national head of U.S. term limits. I was national head of the Privatization Council. I actually did outsource a lot of government spending and gave a ton of money to the Catholic Church, for example, Catholic Charities, which is their social service arm. And I said, you know, I was not on the same side of the abortion and gay rights issues as the Catholic Church was. I was way early in favor of LGBT and strongly pro-choice on the abortion issue. So we would fight all day about that. But at night, you know, we took $300 million of government social service spending and put it out for bids to the private sector. And all these nonprofits, the 501c3s, you know, like operated by the minority community in Boston, they wanted to serve, quote, our people, close quote. They were much cheaper than the public employees were. So we saved money and at the same time released a lot of energy from the private sector, particularly in those minority areas. I've got a lot to say to the minority community on education and on social services. And, you know, I went out to the NAACP annual meeting in Detroit, and I think I did as well there as the 10 Democrats who were also on the stage with me did. Matter of fact, the press said I did better. So there's a lot of things I would do differently than other people are these days. But the main thing would be trying to persuade everybody that we just all got to work together. And I would take the first step, and I would make the submissive gesture so they knew I wasn't trying to put anything over on them.
What would your top issue be?
It probably would be no more trillion-dollar deficits, but right up there with it, because it's a planetary emergency and not just a national emergency, would be climate change and stopping the polar ice cap from melting. I've been all over the world the last 15 years on both law and business, and I spend a lot of time with former world leaders, even current world leaders. And, you know, they say that the number one issue is keeping nuclear nonproliferation, but number two is water. It's going to be terrible. If that polar ice cap melts, every mountain glacier in the world will melt. That's the sole source of drinking water for 300 million people. All of our shorelines will be rearranged. I mean, Portsmouth, Hampton, Northampton, Rye, New Hampshire, forget it. They're not going to be there. I mean, if you got you got a house in Conway, you might have shorefront property, much as I hate to say it. And I don't mean on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee. I mean on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean. So that really is worth rejoining the Paris Accords. And otherwise, you know, the White Mountains aren't going to be white. It's bad enough we lost the old man in the mountain, right? And I'd still like to have the White Mountains so I could come up here and go camping again at Tuckerman's.
So with that, there's always a balance between the economy and the environment, especially when we're talking about green energy. Why hasn't the green energy market really taken off? You're trying to sell something that's free. You know, wind happens. So why hasn't those technologies taken off?
Well, I think they have kind of taken off compared to 10 years ago. I'm not absolutely sure that the subsidies that are there are still necessary. You know, you look at some of the Democrats' plans for combating climate change, and all they include is a dollar sign. Senator Sanders says, I'm going to spend $16.3 trillion. That's more than anybody else. And others, not all of them, but other Democrats kind of try to keep up with him in terms of spending promises. But what we have to do to solve the atmosphere problem is to put a price on carbon. And that ultimately would be paid by the polluters, the emitters, be paid by the coal companies, the oil companies, the gas companies. But we don't have to, you know, and we got to let the market fix a price for carbon responding to the pricing signal. We don't have to shoot Bessie the cow and have no more airplane travel. We just don't have to do that. And it's very easy to establish a pricing mechanism that would create a market incentive for people to withdraw carbon from the atmosphere. And that's what you have to spell out in your climate change plan, as mine does. You can't just throw a dollar sign at it.
Cap and trade to combat tragedy of the commons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. One final issue, firearms, really big in New Hampshire. In fact, one of the states that I think we have the most jobs per capita manufacturing firearms in the
no,
country.
No, I know. I was a great friend of old man Bill Ruger, too. Yeah. I used to go hunting up at Corbin Park in the northwest part of the state, right near Grantham and Croydon. So I've grown up hunting my whole life. But beyond that, I consider guns a liberty issue. And when the government says, no, we're going to make everybody register their rifle and come and show it to the police chief once a year, you know, my blood recoils at that, because you know what will happen. The first year it'll be, thank you for showing us your gun. The second year it'll be, please sign here to license your gun. And the third year it'll be, thanks for coming into the police station, but that gun is staying with us. And history is absolutely replete with examples of where a leader would make it illegal to own firearms, like Idi Amin, probably the worst national ruler of the 20th century in Uganda, made it impossible to own guns. And all the Western press fawningly said, what a forward-looking leader. This is the guy for tomorrow. Of course, he slaughtered everybody as soon as he took all the guns away. So that's why the Second Amendment is there. It's a bulwark against government overreaching and government power. And the people who wrote our Constitution understand that you need those bulwarks because, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
You talked on your website about support for red flag laws.
Yeah, red flag laws I don't have a problem with.
So where does that fall in terms of, like, due process happening after?
You have to have due process. You have to have a probable cause standard. A red flag law, for those of your listeners who may not know, be familiar with the fine points, it would create the opportunity that exists in domestic violence cases, for example, where someone who knew someone else who was making threats or had a history of violence and who they thought was a danger to himself or others, you could go to a judge and petition to have the judge order that that fellow surrender his weapons if the showing was strong enough. But you need a judge to do that, or else it's no good. The government will just take him. So we do need an independent judiciary, as well as protection against the government licensing our firearms. And two-thirds of the gun deaths in the United States every year, and this is a poignant statistic, but they're suicide. They're not from mass shootings. So if you created this cause of action, then people could say, you know, my brother is just way off, and I think he's a danger to himself. So just the same as you could say, my coworker is boasting about how he admires Islamic militants and really thinks a whole lot of people deserve to die. That would be another case where you'd go right in. And believe me, if you get good evidence of that, you're going to get a court order, and you should. That's how we stop the mass shootings.
All right. Well, former governor and presidential hopeful, Bill Weld, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.